Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Finland has deployed dogs trained to smell the coronavirus at the country's main international airport. A trial of this experimental search method will take place for 4 months. If successful, the system could be established as a low-cost and quick way to identify infected travelers. Finland's Smell Detection Association trained the four dogs now at work in the Helsinki airport. It's a very promising method. Dogs are very good at sniffing, said Anna Hjelm Bjorkman, a University of Helsinki professor of animal medicine. If it works, it will be a good screening method, she added. Hjelm Bjorkman believes the dogs could be used at hospitals, ports, group homes for older people, and at large public gatherings. The airport's Twitter page includes an image of one of the newly employed sniffers. Researchers in countries including Australia, France, Germany, and the United States are also studying dogs. But the Finnish trial is among the largest so far. Hjelm Bjorkman told the Associated Press that Finland is the second country, after the United Arab Emirates, and the first in Europe, to use dogs to sniff out the coronavirus. A similar program started at Dubai International Airport over the summer. Passengers who agree to take a free test under the voluntary program in Helsinki do not have direct physical contact with a dog. They are asked to swipe their skin with material, which is then put into a container and given to a dog waiting in a separate place. The animals, E.T., Kosi, Mina, and Valo, all received training in the past to smell cancer, diabetes, or other diseases. The trainers say it takes a dog 10 seconds to sniff the virus samples before it gives the test result by scratching with a paw. They also might lie down, make a noise, or do something else to make their findings known. The process should be completed within 1 minute, said Hjelm Bjorkman. If the result is positive, the passenger is urged to take a coronavirus test to confirm the dog's result. The airport is near Helsinki, in the city of Vantaa. Its deputy mayor, Timo Aronkito, said the program is costing $350,000. He called the amount remarkably lower than other methods of testing arriving passengers. The four sniffer dogs are to work in the airport at different times, with two on duty at a time while the other two get a break. If the scent is easy, it doesn't wear out the dogs too much. But if there are lots of new scents around, dogs do get tired easier, said Annetta Cara of the Smell Detection Association, as she patted her white dog, E.T. I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
A new search tool uses machine learning to search millions of U.S. newspaper pages for historical pictures. The U.S. Library of Congress recently launched the tool called Newspaper Navigator. The online search system is available for free to the public. The Library of Congress is the world's largest library. It offers materials from the creative record of the United States. The library serves as the main research service for the U.S. Congress. Newspaper Navigator currently permits users to search more than 16 million pages from newspapers across the country from 1900 to 1963. The newspaper pages were digitized for another Library of Congress project called Chronicling America. This tool also permits searches across the library's 16 million newspaper pages. The pages contain more than 1.5 million images. The Chronicling America system permits users to find and look at full newspaper pages as digitized images. Users can also search the collection by keyword using optical character recognition, OCR. OCR is a tool that uses digital cameras to identify printed characters on a page for searches or to produce text. This meant that people using the Chronicling America site had to search through newspaper pages themselves when trying to find specific images. The new Newspaper Navigator tool offers the ability to carry out searches based on image-only content in the collection. This is where the machine learning methods come in. The search system was trained to recognize different kinds of images. For example, it was designed to tell the difference between photos, maps, comics, advertisements, etc. It can also identify similar images and return these in search results. Benjamin Lee created the system. He is a member of the Library of Congress's Innovator in Residence program. The program was established to sponsor people from different fields to create new ways to present the library's huge historical collections to the public. Lee trained a machine learning model to identify the visual content and then ran the model over all 16 million pages in Chronicling America. His training model was based on another Library of Congress experiment called Beyond Words. That project invited members of the public to help identify cartoons, drawings, pictures, and advertisements in newspapers during World War I. Lee said that after he learned of the Beyond Words experiment, he saw a great possibility to use that information to power his machine learning tool. "I began to wonder whether this identified visual content was the key to throwing open the treasure chest of visual content throughout all 16 million pages in Chronicling America." Newspaper Navigator works like other search engines. Users enter a search term in the keyword box. They can also choose to limit search results by location as well as by date. But one of the most powerful tools in the system is the ability to search images by visual similarity. Users of the tool can save images to a personal collection. They can then use those images as a basis for finding other visually similar images across the library's full collection. The system even permits users to retrain the machine learning tool for individual searches. This is done by examining the images that the search returns. By selecting whether images found were similar or not similar to the desired result, the user is retraining the system to improve its search performance. A demonstration of the Newspaper Navigator is available to help users learn more about the tool and how to carry out different searches. The creators hope the tool can be useful for historians, reporters, educators, professional researchers, or anyone interested in learning about U.S. history through newspapers. The Library of Congress notes that all images included in Newspaper Navigator and Chronicling America are in the public domain, meaning people are free to use them as they wish. I'm Brian Lynn.
Are you at risk of getting seriously ill from the new coronavirus? Here are some things to keep in mind. 80% of coronavirus cases are mild. Young and healthy people are at low risk. Other people and those with serious health conditions have a greater risk of serious illness or even death. If you have a cough, fever, and difficulty breathing, contact the doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the World Health Organization website at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Andrew Jackson was nearing the end of his presidency. He had served two terms. For many Americans, Jackson remained incredibly popular. They liked that a poor boy from the frontier, who could barely read and write, grew up to to become president. Historian Daniel Feller is an expert on Andrew Jackson. He calls the president and war hero the ultimate American self-made man.
He's a quintessentially American figure. You can't imagine anybody like this getting to be the head of a country at that time, certainly anywhere else but in the United States. And even in the United States, it would have been unheard of just a few years before.
Daniel Feller says Jackson often used government to help ordinary people instead of the rich and powerful. For this reason, many called him the people's president. But not everyone agreed. His opponents said, "Tyrants have always spoken in the name of the people." They said Jackson used his popularity to do whatever he wanted, whether it was legal or not. His opponents in Congress even denounced him with a censure resolution for not releasing some of his papers to the government. They called him King Andrew. Many American Indians called Jackson yet another name. They called him Jackson the Devil. Jackson wanted Native Americans in southern states, including Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee, to move west. Jackson did not think it was right for Indian tribes to exist as independent nations within the United States. And white voters wanted Indians' land for farming. Historian Daniel Feller points out that the United States government had tried to get Indians to move away from white settlements for a long time, long before Jackson became president.
But Jackson brought an urgency to it that none of his predecessors had. Quincy Adams and Monroe had endeavored to remove Indians when Indians seemed to be willing to be removed. Jackson took the position that they need to be removed now.
In 1830, Jackson pushed a bill through Congress called the Indian Removal Act. The bill allowed him to create new Indian homelands in the Oklahoma Territory, an area west of the Mississippi River, where few white Americans lived at the time. The federal government would essentially trade the Indians their old land for the new land and pay for tribes to move west permanently.
He managed to convince himself, and I think that's the best way to put it, that he was actually doing the Indians a favor, that Indian tribes that remained in proximity to whites simply disintegrated. Their tribal structure, their national structure disintegrated. They died.
Daniel Feller says just because Jackson believed he was helping the Indians did not mean he did not benefit from their removal or that he was right. Besides, the Indians did not have much choice. Jackson told them that if they did not accept his offer, their nations would be controlled by the American government. The Chickasaw, Choctaw, and Creeks agreed under pressure. The Cherokees resisted. They even took their case to the Supreme Court, which agreed that the Indians were independent from state authority. But Jackson and the state of Georgia ignored the Supreme Court's decision. Eventually, soldiers forced the Cherokees from their homes and marched them over 1,600 kilometers to Oklahoma. More than 5,000 died. The forced march later became known as the Trail of Tears. Even the Indians who survived continued to suffer. The United States government did not meet the terms of the treaty. Few Indians were paid for their goods. Most were not given food and other supplies during the journey, or when they arrived in Oklahoma. Daniel Feller notes that the United States has a long history of defaulting on its treaties with Indian nations, both before and after Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson might not have intended for the Indians to suffer so much, but he did not lead his government to respect and protect them either.
There are many who regard Jackson as being the kind of epitome, the exemplar, the personification of everything that has been wrong, not only regrettable, but perhaps evil, in white America's treatment of the Indians.
Daniel Feller says Jackson's treatment of the Native Americans, along with some of his other actions, complicates his image as an American hero.
If you look at Jackson's own personal rise, it's a pretty impressive rise. It leaves a lot of dead people and a lot of displaced or abused populations behind it, including Indians, including slaves, including personally the people he shot. So, again, it's a complicated image. It shows this American character in both, you might say, its best and its most disturbing light at the same time.
In 1836, the American public voted for their next president. Andrew Jackson had served for 8 years. He did not want another term. He supported his vice president, Martin Van Buren. Van Buren had been very close to the outgoing president. In the election of 1828, Van Buren had been successful in forming a strong political alliance. This alliance helped put Jackson in the White House. Jackson was grateful for Van Buren's help and asked him to come to Washington to serve as Secretary of State. Van Buren quickly became the most powerful man in Jackson's cabinet. He was able to help Jackson in negotiations with Britain and France. But his greatest help was in building a strong political party for Jackson. Van Buren built up the Democratic Party by removing people from government jobs if they had not supported Jackson. These jobs were then given to those who had supported the president. Ultimately, it was the Democratic Party that gave Jackson wide support for his policies. Van Buren served as Jackson's Secretary of State for 2 years. By this time, Jackson had decided that Van Buren would be the best man to follow him as president. Jackson offered to resign after the 1832 elections and give Van Buren the job of president. Van Buren rejected the offer. He said he wanted to be elected by the people, but he agreed to be Jackson's vice president in 1832. 4 years later, at Jackson's request, the Democrats chose Van Buren to be their presidential candidate. Several candidates from the newly formed Whig Party opposed him, but the Whigs were divided, and Van Buren easily won the election. March 4th, 1837 was a bright, cold day. The winter sun shone over the crowd that had gathered in Washington to watch the swearing-in of the new president. Andrew Jackson left the White House in the presidential carriage, riding beside Martin Van Buren. It was the first time a president and a president-elect rode to the Capitol together for the inauguration. The big crowd on the east side of the Capitol grew quiet when Jackson and Van Buren walked up the steps of the building. After Chief Justice Roger Taney swore in President Van Buren, the new president gave his inaugural speech. Then Andrew Jackson started slowly down the steps. A mighty cheer burst from the crowd. "For once," wrote Senator Thomas Hart Benton, an ally of Jackson, "the rising sun was eclipsed by the setting sun." The day after Van Buren became president, Jackson met with a few of his friends. Frank Blair, the editor of Jackson's newspaper, was one of them. Senator Benton was another. It was a warm, friendly meeting. They thought back over Jackson's years in the White House and talked about what had been done. Jackson said he thought his best piece of work was getting rid of the Bank of the United States. He said he had saved the people from a monopoly of a few rich men. Someone asked about Texas. Jackson said he was not worried about Texas. That problem would solve itself, he said. Did he have any regrets about anything? "Only two," said Jackson. "I regret I was unable to shoot Henry Clay or to hang John C. Calhoun." The next morning, March 6th, Jackson left Washington to return to his home in Tennessee. Jackson was to leave the Capitol by train. Thousands of people lined the streets to the train station, waiting for a last look at their president. Jackson stood in the open air on the rear platform of the train. His hat was off, and the wind blew through his long white hair. The locomotive bell rang, there was a hiss of steam, and the train began to move. Jackson bowed. One man who was there said it was as if a bright star had gone out of the sky. Jackson lived for 8 more years. He read as many as 20 different newspapers, exchanged letters with many people in government, and spent time with his son and grandchildren. But Jackson's health had never been very good. He had been shot many years before, and the gunshot wounds created problems. Andrew Jackson died at home on June 8, 1845. He was 78 years old. Back in Washington, Martin Van Buren continued Jackson's legacy by carrying out many of his policies. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.